The Subcommittee on Health Policy to order, and I'd like to start off with a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 4. Sandy, would you like to tell us what we're doing today? Well, how about describing House Joint Memorial?
Madam Chair, members of the Subcommittee, House Joint Memorial 4 is expressing support for the participation by Taiwan in the World Health Organization. This is a memorial, and it will be filed with the Secretary of State. There is obviously no fiscal impact or revenue impact, and I believe we have a presenter from the Taiwan Consulate to give us a PowerPoint.
So, please join us.
I asked him, but I doubt it. And revenue is still going.
No revenue.
Madam the Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Yu Qi-in, counsel from Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Seattle. First of all, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to speak before the committee. And presentation is to mainly to explain why Taiwan wants to participate in the World Health Organization, which is the main purpose of the HJM for supporting Taiwan's participation in WHO. And first of all, Taiwan has 23 million citizens and 400,000 plus foreign nationals living in Taiwan. And for the past quarter of a century, Taiwan has been denied access to the World Health Organization, WHO, which is the major health forum of the world. And but actually, the WHO Constitution enshrines the principle of the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of health is one of the fundamental rights of every human being. So Taiwan people actually is being denied of this fundamental rights. Mm-hmm. And why Taiwan is important to the Global Disease Prevention Network? Each year we have 8 million people make trips abroad, and 3 million travel to Taiwan. And also 175,230 flights arrive and depart from Taiwan.
Excuse me, one moment. Is it Ms. Yin or Ms. Yu?
Yin, yes.
Yin. Yin?
Yeah.
Will you be providing us a copy of the PowerPoint?
Sure.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Okay. We appreciate it.
Right, and all these numbers are just to illustrate the importance of Taiwan in the international network. Because of this frequent communication with the rest of the world, that Taiwan is a important part, indispensable part of the Global Disease Prevention Network. And also, each year, Taiwan has 355 species of migratory birds a number 1.3 million that arrives and leaves Taiwan. So everybody knows the importance to prevent the outbreak of the avian influenza. So this number illustrates also how important to integrate Taiwan into this global disease prevention network. And the next question is, why the WHO matters to Taiwan? Actually, WHO, being the most important major health forum in the world, provides the mechanism to prevent outbreaks of the infectious disease, and also the allocation of vaccines and other disease control supplies. And Taiwan not being included in the WHO are denied of these resources. And these are just two example, concrete examples to illustrate how Taiwan was hurt not being a member of the WHO. Maybe some of you would remember that in 1999, a serious earthquake happened in Taiwan, and more than 2,000 people were killed at that time. Taiwan did got many rescue missions support from all over the world, but the WHO didn't participate in this mission, in these missions. And in 2003, the severe acute respiratory syndrome, the SARS, attacked Taiwan seriously. And totally, Taiwan has 664 reported cases. And also one municipal hospital with 1,000 patients and medical professionals were quarantined at that time. And Taiwan, not being included in the WHO, relied entirely on the help from the American Center for Disease Control for the test of the specimens. The specimens were forced to be sent to the U.S. instead of a nearby WHO office in the Western Pacific region, which is a serious delay for this disease control. And the WHO finally sent experts to Taiwan to help Taiwan's authority to control this disease, but it was 2 months after the first outbreak. And totally in the SARS disease, totally 73 people were killed. So representatives might have questioned that why Taiwan repeat our campaign each year. In fact, the Oregon legislature have passed in 2003 and 2005 session a similar health joint memorial to support Taiwan's participation in WHO. So why are we doing this again? This is because of the difficult international situation faced Taiwan, that Taiwan is still being denied of the participation in the WHO. And the World Health Assembly, which is the most important decision-making body of the WHO, is held in Geneva every year in May. So Taiwan, every year, just keep knocking on the door of the WHO before May. And so we are trying to collect as much support as possible before May. That explains why we keep asking Oregon legislature's support to express your support for Taiwan to participate in the World Health Organization. And maybe some people will have concerns that a state level support wouldn't really matters, but actually it did matters. Taiwan from the start was totally excluded from the WHO system, but over these past years, because of these worldwide supports, including each state from the United States support, Taiwan now has limited access to some certain expert meetings and to the Global Alert and Response Network. This network is a mechanism under the WHO. So this illustrates that your support really is important to us. So the HJM4 only supports Taiwan's meaningful and appropriate participation in WHO, which has no political connotation or implication that some might have concern about. So we just urge and request Oregon's legislature to show your support once again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Yan?
I have a question.
Yes, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Ms. Yan. Thank you for being here. In your opinion, what is the primary reason why Taiwan has been denied access year after year?
Honestly speaking, it's because of the political pressure from the mainland China. Because mainland China always, they consider Taiwan as part of China. So this is the famous One China policy. And they just put pressure to WHO that WHO couldn't include Taiwan as a member or an observer or whatsoever. Let's go back to the SARS year in 2004, actually. Taiwan has sent, in the beginning of the outbreak, has asked WHO's help. But the mainland China actually just asked WHO to step back because Taiwan is part of China, and China is already the member of the WHO. And mainland China actually takes good care of Taiwan, so there's no need to send directly experts or assistance from WHO to Taiwan. And so very sadly, this is the international political situation that we have to face. So, but actually Taiwan has nothing to do, in fact, of mainland China's authority for the moment. And certainly Taiwan didn't receive any direct assistance from mainland China at that moment. And so I hope this could answer to Representative's question.
Thank you. Other questions? I just want to thank you for coming, and again, another session asking us to adopt this resolution. It's, you know, concerning how every country is interconnected with travel and other things. And the irony there is that China has just as much interest in keeping Taiwan healthy as the rest of us do, that it's unfortunate you have to be excluded. But
yes,
this is very helpful. We'd be very interested in having, for the record, a copy of your PowerPoint
yes,
to reference. And if there are no other questions, and I don't think we have anyone else set to testify, thank you for your time. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 4 and open a work session on House Joint Memorial 4.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelson?
I would move House Joint Memorial 4 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
It would be a due adopt.
It is a due adopt recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Representative Gelser has moved House Joint Memorial 4 to the full committee with a due adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Aaron, would you call the roll?
Representative Floyd.
Aye.
Representative
Gelson. Aye.
Vice Chair
Bonamici.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Brown. Excuse.
Chair
Aye. And with that, House Joint Memorial goes on, four, goes on to the full committee. Representative Gelson, would you like to carry to the full?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mission. Yes, and yes. And I've started to receive materials from Sandy, so we're also going to get our materials for the full committee. Thank
yes.
you very much. Appreciate it. Now let's open a work session on House Bill 3092. 3092. The revised uniform
anatomy. Somewhere else.
Oh, got it.
There it is. Thank you.
Mr. Shatterly? Is it appropriate to call you representative? The or the honorable? I don't even know the right.
Madam Chair,
Director.
You know, my understanding is that that is an honorific, but
extends forever. Frankly, I don't require it.
But I'm happy to use it. Representative Shetterly, nice to have you back.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. And Madam Chair, anyone that can also use honorific in an introductory section should be addressed.
You get points for that. So we have before us again House Bill 3092. We did have a public hearing on this, and we're in work session. And Sandy, could you describe what you have for us, and then maybe we'll have Representative Shetterly answer questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. You recall we at the public hearing, which was on April 10th, we did have at that time the dash one and dash twos. After folks gave testimony just on the bill and including the amendments, there was a request to have further explanation of the amendments. I was not able to totally grasp the historical value, which is why I then encouraged former Representative Shetterly to come back and provide the committee with all the information on the amendments before you actually worked it. What I did do is provide you with a hand engrossed bill that incorporates the dash one and two so that you could at least have an easy read of that. But we are here to kind of give you additional information at your request.
And I understand that you also emailed some of us this morning, I believe. Do you want to go over that email since that addressed some people's questions?
I hope so. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Lane Shetterly, appearing before you today as a member of the Oregon delegation to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. I did get word this morning from staff that Representative Flores had requested some explanation, and I think it's fair because these dash one and dash two amendments aren't necessarily self-explanatory. And I hope that what I offered is satisfactory. For the record, I will address my comments to the full subcommittee. The dash one amendments really do two things. On the first page of the dash one amendments, you have an amendment to the bill that harmonizes this bill, 3092, with Oregon law in that it recognizes and coordinates the bill with Oregon's existing registry system. This uniform bill, of course, was adopted by states around the country, some of which may have, some of which may not have registry systems. Oregon, of course, has one in place, and so the language on page one of the dash one amendments really is just a technical amendment that harmonizes the registry language in the bill with what we have in place in Oregon already with the donor registry. Pages two and three and on to page four principally also are more in the way of technical amendments at the request of Dr. Karen Gunderson and also recommended by the National Association of Medical Examiners. They conform the practices in the bill to appropriate protocols that are recognized by medical examiners when they are faced with anatomical gift situations. And so in those respects, those are not particularly substantive in any policy terms. They are really more just a matter of making sure that the bill works with best practices. The dash two amendments have just a touch more of policy to them. When this bill was promulgated by the National Conference, it went out and drew some attention relative to Section 18 sub 2 in that it appeared to create a presumption if you have an incapacitated person, presumption in favor of donative intent. The dash two amendments recognize, in fact, that donative intent should be determined the same way that we make other healthcare decisions. So if there is a healthcare directive, that decision should be made by the person appointed as the healthcare representative in the directive. If not, it falls down the same statutory hierarchy that exists for other healthcare decisions if the person's intent cannot be clearly determined. So there was a concern that otherwise the bill would create a presumption of donative intent when in fact that donative intent may not have been made clear. So this amendment really is in keeping with what I think you heard from the other hearing that where the default is in favor of opt-in as opposed to opt-out. So if an intent is clear from the donor, then the procedure goes forward. If it is not clear, this item sets out the process by which donative intent can be determined, and it follows the same hierarchy of other health care decisions.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Additional questions or comments? Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a comment, Mr. Director, Representative Shetterly.
That's three.
And honorific as they may be.
Yeah.
I do want to thank you very much for the email, which, alas, as Representative Bruin is fond to say, I did not even have time to log into my computer yesterday. So, but thank you very much for preparing that. It does help me kind of track, so I appreciate the time you put into that.
And thank you. We can share that with the full committee as well.
Absolutely. I wasn't sure where the request was coming from. I knew it was coming from Representative Forrest. I wanted to make sure the chair and co-chair got it, but you're welcome to make that part of the record.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Other questions?
Yes, I'd like that.
I'm sorry, Representative.
Wayne, would you work us through who can make a decision on an anatomical gift after death on the part of a unemancipated minor or some other person who's not capable of making an informed consent decision? I think that's section 3.
Yeah. Section 3 begins with the description of who can make an anatomical gift. In sub 2, it says the gift can be made in the manner provided in section 4 by the donor if the donor is an adult, or if the donor is an emancipated minor, or authorized to apply for an instruction permit that puts them into the Department of Transportation opt-in provision when you get a driver's license or permit, or an agent of the donor, unless the power of attorney for health care or other record prohibits the agent from making an anatomical gift, parent of the donor if the donor is an unemancipated minor or the donor's guardian. That's essentially who you are looking at in terms of authority to make those decisions. I think it also is clear that, as I think Mike Seeley expressed in his testimony when this was before you last week, that it does grant minors who can apply for a driver's license the power to make anatomical gifts by opting into the Department of Transportation system. However, it also allows a parent to revoke the gift if that minor dies while under the age of 18, still a minor.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Additional questions? I just have one, I think. On the Dash 1 amendments, I think this is very exciting, the idea of having the information exchange between the Department of Transportation and the donor registry. Are you comfortable with the confidentiality comments that started on line 18 there? Because we've essentially passing, granted, relatively limited personal information to a non-public entity, would be my understanding. Was that brought up at all? I was just wondering.
Madam Chair, I would say that I am comfortable with it because the experts in the transplant bank are comfortable with it. Medical professionals that have looked at this are comfortable with it. That language has not created any concerns on the part of those who know better than I how this and the registry work.
Okay.
Again, I think that is all intended to reflect language that is already part of the registry program for the state.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Other comments, questions? I don't think we have any more.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming back. I really appreciate that.
And with that, I'd entertain a motion to move this on to the full committee.
Okay.
Representative Gilson.
I would move. Do we still need to move the Dash 1?
I'm sorry. Yes, we need to move it once and two. Yes.
I would move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3092.
I'm sorry, did you do both?
I just did that. Don't we have to do them
separately? Oh, one at a time. Okay. So the motion on the table from Representative Gelser is the Dash 1s to amend 3092. All those in favor? Or any objections? Thank you.
Seeing none, so moved. Representative Gelser?
I would move the -2 amendments to House Bill 3092.
Representative Gelser has moved the -2s to House Bill 3092. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Gelser?
Yes, I would move House Bill 3092 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Gelser has moved House Bill 3092 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Erin, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Flores. Aye.
Representative
Gelser.
Aye.
Aye. Hughes. Aye. And with that, House Bill 3092 with the amendments is on to the full committee. And do I have a carrier? Representative Greenwald?
Oh, sure. I'll be happy to. Is there anything we can do to facilitate getting whatever information? I mean, this is going to be a complicated one that would be useful if the rest of the committee has some.
Well, I think
we can get it all out to them today, sir.
Well, I do think the testimony, especially the supportive testimonies, should clear the way for
this
feeling.
This will be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. It'll give a good sense of there's no opposition.
And Madam Chair, Representative Green, anything in particular? Because I would hand them the amendments, the Hamden Groves, former Representative Shetterly's explanation. Is there anything in particular in addition that you want them to have? And the testimony.
And the testimony.
Okay. Yeah, no, we can do that.
And when do we have this scheduled?
I believe it's up for Friday.
Up for Friday? Okay. All right. Did I close it?
No.
So we'll close the work session on House Bill 3092 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3093. So if you recall, we had a public hearing on this
on the 5th.
This is a addition to the Bill of Rights for residents and patients of long-term care facilities, and wanted to have another hearing today to get a little more testimony on this, and look, we have some. I particularly wanted to start off with the department because they weren't here the other day, and one of the things we heard was that there had been some efforts to address some of these issues by rule, and I want to hear the department's perspective. So Mary Geer, please come up. And for the other individuals who are signed up, I think these are folks who were here last time, pretty much. Jim, Holly, Roger Anderson, might not have been here last time. Mae Bosch, and then Lauren Rose, and then Ozzie Rose. If you could, I would like to have some response to what the department has to say, or I did have some information from Lauren, so try to, I don't need reiterated testimony, further comments in relation to what the department has to say would be helpful. Thank you.
Chair Kotek and members of the committee, my name is Mary Geer. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care for Seniors and People with Disabilities in the Department of Human Services. Our office licenses and regulates nursing facilities, residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, and adult foster homes. And I'm here to provide the information that you requested from the department on House Bill 3093. I'm going to start at the back of my written testimony, if you don't mind, and just point out to you that we've provided you with the current federal and state rules and regulations for resident rights in those settings, assisted living, residential care, nursing facility, and adult foster home. Under the nursing facility rights, you'll find two different sets. One of them is the federal regulations that are in federal law for nursing facilities, which are federally regulated for Medicare and Medicaid, and then the state rules for the assisted living, residential care, and adult foster homes. The bill makes changes to the nursing facility statute. We understand that the intent was to apply these changes proposed to all of the long-term care facilities, and so that's why I'm going to address all of those. There were three specific areas that were proposed in the bill for change. One was to add a section that talks about a resident's right to receive care from a staff that's specifically trained in a particular disease or condition. And what I wanted to do with each of these was simply to go through and let you know what's currently required under regulation in each of those settings. And by setting, it's a little bit different, so we've broken them out in the testimony, and I'll go over them real briefly. In a nursing facility, care is given by licensed nurses and certified nursing assistants. The CNAs, nursing assistants, have training that includes some specific diseases, 14 specific diseases as part of their training, and Parkinson's is one of those. Licensed nurses in nursing facilities receive their training through their educational program and receive disease-specific training as part of their educational background. In assisted living and residential care facilities, caregivers are required to have an orientation, and that orientation is specific to any kind of medical assessments or treatments that need to be given in that setting. And then there's also a requirement for continuing education for caregivers. And if I might back up a minute, there's the same requirement for continuing education in nursing facilities, and then licensed nurses have whatever requirement is attached to their license. In adult foster homes, there's a basic training that's required for the provider who lives in the home or their house manager. That includes a variety of things, including assessment and what treatments might be required for the residents in their home. And again, there is a continuing education requirement to that. So there is currently training that's required. In some settings, it's disease-specific. In general, the requirement is that when admitting a resident to a particular setting, the caregiver or the facility has the obligation to assess that person excuse me, to make sure that they can meet their needs and make sure that they've got staff trained able to meet those needs. The second area that is proposed for the Bill of Rights is medication management assistance specific to a disease or a condition. In nursing facilities, medications are required to be passed by either a licensed nurse or a certified medication aide. And in those cases, either the aide is specially trained or, of course, the nurse receives training as part of their education to be able to pass medications. And the general requirement would be that those medications be passed as ordered by the physician based on the doctor's orders. In an assisted living facility or residential care facility, staff who are responsible for passing medications are required to be observed and evaluated to ensure that they have the proper training to be able to administer those meds or pass those medications in accordance with the order from the physician. And it's much the same in an adult foster home setting, that the staff has to demonstrate an understanding of what's required for the particular residents in that home and that the medication be passed. The last area that's proposed for change has to do with modified or special diets. Currently in nursing facilities, there is a regulation, a requirement that therapeutic diets be offered according to doctor's orders. In assisted living and residential care facilities, there is not currently a rule in place to address this. However, as part of the rulemaking process, we have proposed rules out that we hope will take effect in October of this year that will require that RCFs and ALFs provide a modified or special diet as required or requested. And then again, it's the same in adult foster homes. There is a requirement that a special or modified diet be given in accordance with doctor's orders.
Ms. Gear, when you say required by rule in both
cases? Required by rule. Okay. That's right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kotek, just to respond a little bit more, in the nursing home setting, there may be state law, there may be federal law, there may be both. The other community-based care settings are regulated by state law and by state rules.
Okay.
In general, we would say that as a department, we certainly agree that proper training for caregivers is a big part of ensuring quality of care for the residents in those settings. There are residents' rights, as I mentioned, that are specific to those settings in rule and state rule and federal legislation, which we provided you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and we'll be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Questions for Ms. Gear? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Garrett. The federal regulations for nursing facilities, Oregon administrative rules, licensing for nursing facilities, I see residents' rights, Oregon administrative rules, assisted living care facilities, adult foster homes, all of those that are an attachment that you gave us, would those be considered individually and or collectively as residents' Bill of Rights then?
I would, Chair Kotek and Representative Flores, I would say yes. You'll notice on the page that has the federal regulations for nursing facilities, mm-hmm. next to each right there is an F followed by some numbers.
Right.
That's the specific federal citation that can be given if that right is violated against a resident or a number of residents in the facility. So, for example, if the facility didn't allow a resident to have access to their clinical records, we would issue a citation of F-153. So it would be considered a Bill of Rights. It's also a regulatory tool.
Perfect. Thank you.
Other questions? I have a couple. What gets posted in the long-term care facilities? Let's just stick to the skilled nursing home, since that's directly how the bill relates right now. But are these rights or regulations posted? One of the points made from the proponents is customer empowerment, basically, making sure they know their rights. And I'm just wondering, what is posted? Does this require stuff to be posted? I'm just wondering how that works, practically speaking.
Representative Chair Kotek, I'm counting on my memory here, and I can confirm this for you. I believe it's a federal requirement that the Bill of Rights be posted in nursing facilities. I would have to check on the state rules regarding the community-based care facilities. Typically, residents are provided their rights in an admission packet to a facility. Now, admittedly, that's often with papers that are about this thick, and so, you know, may or may not be pointed out to them, may or may not be gone over with them. The other entity I guess I would mention as having a responsibility to ensure residents' rights is the long-term care ombudsman in all of these settings. It's specifically the ombudsman's charge. And an ombudsman will often go over resident rights, particularly in complaint situations, to make sure that residents understand what their rights are.
Thank you. And I was noticing under the OAR 411, where it talks about residents' rights and protections, that the facility must implement a resident's Bill of Rights. Are they required to include this language, the federal language? Is it the federal Bill of Rights when you say that should be posted, so they're getting some version of the F, you know, this, the ones that start off with F-151,
F-152. Chair Kotek, typically it will include all of these things. And then there may be some facility-specific things that they may add. An example I can think of is some facilities will adopt a culture change model, which means that they have certain organizational practices and resident involvement. They might put something like that in their Bill of Rights in addition to these things, but usually the expectation and practice is that these things would be in a Bill of Rights.
Okay. And then I guess my other question is, one of the concerns that at least I've heard is, by putting something in statute like this, it would somehow drive new rulemaking or new regulation or new something that would require the facilities to do something different. There seems to be a lot of this existing. I guess, could you help me out here? I mean, if we put a Bill of Rights in the statute, does that change what we're doing now? Will it drive things differently? I mean, just from your experience.
Chair Kotek, what it would require us to do in the department is to incorporate these rights into the regulatory practices that we have. So when we go into a facility, for example, to survey, that would be every year in a nursing facility or every 2 years in community-based care facility, we check in and make sure that residents' rights are being followed. We would add this to the list. And so there may be some... it may be that we would have to add these to our rules to make sure that they are incorporated and then make it part of our survey process. That's not a big deal to do that. It's just something we would have to do. On the facility side of things in terms of training, providers can address this probably more thoroughly than I can. My guess would be that they are, if they're not providing some condition-specific training for particular caregivers for particular residents right now, that's something that they might have to change significantly in the facility. So, for example, a caregiver who might be assisting a resident who has Parkinson's may have had an introduction to the condition as a part of his or her CNA training, but whether that would need to be more training, what that might look like, how often it would have to be, can a caregiver provide care to a resident that when they haven't had that training, what if there isn't a staff person who has had that training? Those are the kinds of regulatory questions that we would need to address in some kind of interpretive guidelines to implementing these rules.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bringing that up, the condition-specific training and education element. Has the Department ever contracted with entities, providers, to conduct condition-specific education and training elements?
Chair Kotek and Representative Flores, it's my understanding that the Department has. There are some conditions that require a fair amount of our attention and that we train on a lot. One of those would be Alzheimer's dementia, very common condition in the long-term care setting and something that we would provide training on. Another example would be in some specialized settings for traumatic brain injury. There's specific behavioral and condition type training that comes with that. So yes, we have done some contracting in the past.
Thank you.
Representative Greenwood.
Yes, thank you. You said it's your understanding that that this bill is intended to relate to more than nursing homes. And I'm finding the definition a little confusing. It says that it refers to long-term care facilities as defined in 442015, I think.
Representative Greenlake, and some of us might be working under the assumption of the proponents last time had recommended that they actually wanted this to be amended. Their intent of drafting was...
That is, just to amend it.
But currently it's not. Currently it's just the nursing
may not.
Yes, no?
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No. I think now it looks like it applies basically to nursing homes. And when you get into med management and things like that, it seems a logical thing to happen. The extension of it to other long-term care facilities, and maybe you have to follow a little trail as usual through the statutes to see if something else is included in a different section. But as it currently is, it applies to basically nursing homes.
And Ms. Geer, would you agree with that? That's my understanding as well, that it's just for...
Chair Kotek, as written, that was our interpretation as well, as it was just for nursing facilities. We decided to provide you information on all facilities based on the testimony from the last hearing.
Yes, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Gelser. Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't see it in the testimony. Does the department have a position on this bill?
Chair Kotek and Representative Gelser were neutral on this bill.
And one final question, just to shift gears a little bit. An issue has been brought to my attention about how we apply the civil monetary penalties when something is not in compliance, when you go out and visit and something's not working right. And those dollars collected apparently go back in the general fund. that seems to not incentivize. It doesn't provide the resources maybe to correct some of the things that might be going wrong. Do you have any thoughts? Is that accurate, that what happens if there's a penalty applied to a nursing home, for example, the money is paid to a fund elsewhere, it doesn't somehow get redirected back into the nursing home for... I'm just making sure I understand the process.
Sure. Chair Kotek, I'm going to need to talk about nursing facilities and then community-based care facilities again. The civil penalties that are imposed on the nursing facility in the nursing facility setting have federal regulations. And the federal requirement is that those funds be kept separate and that they be used for the benefit of residents in nursing facilities. And there's some federal guidance on what that exactly means. States use it for a variety of different kinds of things. In the past, we've used that fund for training for providers. It may not necessarily go back to the specific nursing homes that paid the fine to assist them in fixing whatever their issues were, but it's more, we tend to use it more globally for the benefit of nursing facility residents in the state. On the community-based care side, the use of the civil penalty funds is governed by state regulation, and those funds are collected and kept in a separate account that comes back to seniors and people with disabilities, and we tend to view those monies separately as well and use those for the benefit of residents in community-based care settings. So we modeled that after the federal requirement, and we've used that for training and those kinds of things in the past.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you for the clarification.
Mm-hmm. Other questions for the department?
Thank you for being here. I appreciate the testimony.
Thank
Very
you.
Helpful. It fills in some of the gaps from last time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call a few of the proponents back up to see if they have any kind of comments to the department's testimony. Jim, I don't know if you all need to come up. And Ms. Bash, you did not testify. Bash?
Yes, I wasn't able to attend the last hearing.
Okay, then maybe I'll have you come up since you didn't attend last time before we get on to Jim, if you want.
And then the gentleman in Walker was coming up.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir.
Yeah. Is that Roger?
Do you want me to?
Oh, Roger, come on up since you're headed this way.
Roger.
Good, we all could use some walking. So,
Chair, do you want me here too?
Yes, yeah, sure. That'd be great. But Ms. Bash, if you want to go first, that would be great.
Okay.
Or is that Dash? Is that what you've been
Dash.
Trying to tell me?
So
thank
am
you.
I writing for
B. B, gotcha.
Chair Kotek and members of the subcommittee, my name is May Dash, and I'm speaking for the Alzheimer's Network of Oregon. We are a Salem-based nonprofit organization, and we urge approval of House Bill 3093. Our mission is to support the educational, social, emotional, and spiritual needs of individuals with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias and their families and caregivers. The population that we advocate for, persons with debilitating and irreversible dementia, includes some of the most vulnerable residents in long-term care. An estimated 60 to 70% of the residents in Oregon's nursing homes and community-based care facilities, and that, as you well know, is adult foster care homes, assisted living facilities, and residential care facilities, suffer from some type of dementia, and it's most commonly Alzheimer's disease. As Oregon's population ages, the incidence of dementia increases. And regarding the inclusion of community-based care, we did, and I had this in my written testimony, we did understand that the original bill, the intent of the original bill was to include community-based care, all types of long-term care, not just nursing homes, as implied by the ORS that was referred to. And we asked that an amendment be considered to ensure inclusion of community-based care facilities, where we have some of our problems. The most important element of the bill for those afflicted with irreversible dementia is spelled out in Section 2, Number 3A, quote, the right to receive care from facility staff trained to provide care that is specific to the resident's or patient's disease or medical condition. Certainly the other two enumerated rights in the bill regarding medication and diet are also can be important to people with Alzheimer's. During the past legislative sessions, advocates have worked for adequate standards in Oregon's long-term care facilities and have raised concerns about the often inadequate training of caregivers in community-based care. Nursing homes, as Mary Geer referred to, are required to have certified nursing assistants, CNAs, as they are known, as caregivers. The fact that community-based care facilities, also Alzheimer's care units, are not required to have CNAs is a concern to those residents with dementia. Neither the training required for these lay caregivers nor the qualifications of their trainers are addressed adequately in the administrative rules. By contrast, the CNA receives substantial training in dementia care. Last year, the Oregon State Board of Nursing, which regulates CNA training, facilitated a work group, including advocates, that put together an advanced dementia training module, an elective for persons who already are CNAs. Persons who care for people with Alzheimer's must have adequate training in dementia care. Even in the early stages, the afflictive individual may be forgetful, confused, often irrational. Eventually, some of these people become so cognitively impaired that they are unable to communicate. Often, they exhibit behavioral problems. By the time a person with Alzheimer's enters long-term care, the at-home caregiver, often an elderly spouse or an adult child, is exhausted. Thus, the caregiver hired in a nursing home or community-based care setting to care for not just one, but a number of persons exhibiting the symptoms of Alzheimer's is faced with a daunting task. A facility caregiver who lacks adequate dementia-specific training, perhaps patience and maturity as well, eventually may become short-tempered and frustrated, even abusive. The consumer or the family member who seeks a safe, well-run facility for the individual with Alzheimer's has the right to know that the resident's caregivers will have had adequate training in dementia care, and it's for that reason that the Alzheimer's Network supports House Bill 3093. Thank you for listening to our concerns.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for your testimony. Can we get a copy of your written testimony?
Yes,
we can make, we can, Aaron can make
I have
copies.
It.
Oh, okay,
I brought
great.
Copies, I just
oh, wonderful,
to
thank
us.
You. Questions for Ms. Dash?
Well, yeah, I really, I guess I really need to continue, particularly since she mentioned the relating to clause. Relating to clause is relating to long-term care facilities, and there's a specific definition of long-term care facilities in the Oregon statutes, which is referred to in that definition as facility, long-term care facilities as defined in 442.015. 442.015 has a definition of long-term care facilities, and it basically means a skilled nursing facility or an intermediate care facility. So this bill, with I think even within the relating to clause, can only be referring to skilled nursing facilities and intermediate care facilities. And substantively, it makes a big difference. I mean, if we're talking about the issues of, say, a residential care facility providing a caregiver that's specifically trained in a particular disease, I mean, that could change the whole nature of our residential care facilities and our foster care facilities. I mean, it really substantively becomes a very different bill.
And the obverse of that is probably the skilled nursing facilities are probably the best equipped to, if not, they're already capable of doing all these things, is my...
Not they should be. That's the...
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just a comment. I think that probably the skilled nursing facilities theoretically would be the places that are best able to serve them. I think that the benefit, if there was a time to come back and look at those other care settings, is that Oregon has adopted a value of serving people in the least restrictive type of environment and more community-based care settings. And I think certainly for people with Parkinson's or dementia, we certainly wouldn't want to say the only place that has the ability to support you is a very restrictive skilled nursing facility as opposed to a foster care setting or a more community-based care setting. So although this bill might not be a vehicle that allows us to address that, perhaps that is something that we should revisit at another date to see how are our more community-based care programs equipped and what can we better do to strengthen those supports and those least restrictive community-based settings for these populations of folks.
Yeah, absolutely, because Alzheimer's patients can be taken care of in an adult foster home and in an RCF under certain circumstances. It really does. I mean, either we're letting things happen that shouldn't happen, but you also can't make them nursing homes. I mean, it's a really important dilemma.
Ms. Dash, I'm just wondering about Alzheimer care in certain facilities. I'm most I visited an assisted living facility that had an Alzheimer's unit. Is that the norm? And I'm just wondering how it is in can you give us a description of what's the norm in the various types of
facilities? Right. Well, the problem is that over the years that Alzheimer's residents are throughout the spectrum of long-term care. And in 91, when assisted living was being developed, our state Alzheimer's Public Policy Committee, a group of family members and volunteers, we very strongly felt that assisted living was not an appropriate setting for people with Alzheimer's. There wasn't the staffing necessary, the numbers of staff, or the training of staff. And yet, nowadays, it's a known fact that there are many people with dementia, even in assisted living facilities. And so over time, things have changed considerably. Regarding the Alzheimer's care units, that was a bill that we passed, as I recall, I believe it was in 91. And that is a special endorsement. And it's part of, it's not, they're standalone facilities, but they're either residential care facilities with that endorsement, the whole facility is an Alzheimer's care unit. It's sort of a strange, but even assisted living can have Alzheimer's care units, but they're special units, certainly nursing homes, right? And sometimes there are great concerns because staff who are in the main part of the facility who maybe don't have that much training, if they're short-staffed in the Alzheimer's care unit, they end up there, right? And the Alzheimer's care unit bills, over and over again, we who are Alzheimer's advocates have urged that they be revised. They're really out of date at this point. But I think the hope of SPD was to revise the residential care facility rules, and again, the assisted living were sort of morphed in with those the last year they've been working on them, and then eventually to do the Alzheimer's care unit rules.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Other questions from Ms. Dash? Thank you for being here. Appreciate your testimony. Jim and Roger? Identify yourself for the record, and primarily I'm just interested in your feedback of where we might go with this bill and your comments to the testimony from the department.
Sure. I'm Jim Davis, representing Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, and the United Seniors of Oregon. We, of course, are very strongly supportive of this effort because, you know, our concern is that it addresses three major areas. It addresses staff training on disease topics. It addresses critical issues around timing of medications, particularly for Parkinsonian individuals, but for people with other diseases as well. And then it looks at dietary issues. And I guess, you know, we look at the arguments that have been presented by the Oregon Healthcare Association, who is an organization we respect and work very closely with and are friends, but we just have different perspectives on this issue. And they raised issues around the necessity for this bill and the potential additional hurdles and difficulties the bill might cause and create. And I know that we've already brought those out. But we feel that if it's something that they're already expected to do, and it's clearly outlined that they are, and I think the testimony by SPD showed that, particularly around diet and timing of medications, those are really key issues, then why would it be so problematic to just include it in the Bill of Rights? And it does make sense. And so that, and I quote Mary, it's no big deal, and I don't think it is any big deal. Now, the issue that Mitch raises, I think, is very, very critical, and it could be that we will have to just settle with nursing homes, and we're more than happy to do that if we need to. That was not our intent. That is not what we submitted to Legislative Council. We meant for all of the long-term care facilities to be covered. But at this point, if we can at least take that one step for nursing homes, that would be a good step forward, and we can come back and do the rest later. But so we wouldn't have a problem with that. Our preferences include all long-term care facilities, but we certainly would go along with that compromise.
Thank you, Jim. And Mr. Anderson, I'm not sure, I don't remember if you testified last time.
My wife did.
That is correct. Thank you. Appreciate the reminder. Any comments?
Me?
Wait, if you wanted to add anything, feel free.
Okay.
You don't have to.
Yes, my name is Roger Anderson, and I've had Parkinson's disease for 18 years. And what I'd like to do is share last year with you, if I may, to show you what I ran up against. I've been home now 6 months since my last surgery. In January of last year, I had a herniated disc and I had a surgery. Then in March, I had to redo it because the first one didn't take. Then in June, complications arise. I had an infection in my spinal cord. In July, then later, we had to have we went to a nursing home. I was there 3 weeks, and we'll get back to that in a little bit, what treatment that we got in there. In August, I had surgery on my back because 70% of my lower spinal cord was disintegrated. And so I had to have a fusion. And I was in surgery 7 hours the first time and 3 hours the second time. From this, I went then to another rehab after that and then was able to go home. While I was in the hospital and in the first rehab, they were more interested in getting you up and walking. That was their only concentration. They didn't give much of a hoot about whether you got your Parkinson's medication or not. They were dealing more familiar with it, so they didn't care to do anything about it. They got irritated when I started looking to see what was in the cup before I'd swallowed them to get the right stuff. And then the second rehab that I went to was more organized. They would come in every morning. The doctor would ask you how you're doing, what was going on, how you're feeling. They had a regimented, they had speech therapy, rehab therapy, and I've forgotten the third one already. Exercise, basically. But they worked with you every day. They had the same fellow came and woke me up every morning, got me dressed, worked with me, praised you every time you did something good. You got to where you got tired of hearing "good job, Roger." But you did appreciate it, though, because they were trying. And once a week, they'd have a meeting, and they'd get together with all the committee, or your group, because I had the same people every day, and tell me how I was doing, and what I could look forward to going home. And when they told me I'd go home for 2 days' stay, they were very excited. But there's one other thing that I thought was interesting, and that is Parkinson's Resource Centers of Oregon made up a information sheet for patients to say what drugs they're on and medications and various things. And my wife filled it out several times, and only one person ever asked her a question about it. So it slowly getting back. It's like I say, it's been 6 months. I'm just getting a little fog cleared out now from various medications, because when you go into surgery and you go into anesthesia, certain drugs from Parkinson's do not work. And when I was having trouble with walking, I went finally back, got a chance to go to my neurologist, and he said it's not a problem that they could cure. It's a Parkinson's problem, you're walking. So if they would have known that, it would have saved them and me a lot of time and aggravation. And that's really about all I have to say.
Well, thank you for your testimony. It's good to see you up and around.
Thank you. It's good to be up and around.
I bet. Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Greenlight.
Thank you very much.
Jim, the language of the med management is pretty sort of general. It says that patient has a right to obtain assistance from the facility staff in administering medications that meet the specific requirements of the resident's or patient's disease and medical conditions. Mm-hmm. The arguments we've heard, the testimony we've heard, is how those individuals how it screws up. And they don't get things on time and a variety of things, but I wonder if that's within a rights statement, I have the right to get assistance that meets my needs, and we're trying to give it to you, and on the other hand, we forgot to give you this pill this morning. How does this assure that things will happen correctly with this language?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Greenlight, I think what it does is it by putting it in the rights, as SPD said, it's something that they're going to pay extra attention to when they come in. They're going to start looking at these things, start looking how timing issues have been met, because now you know there's enough leeway in both directions that oftentimes Parkinsonians are in a very tough situation by the time they get their meds. And this would just give a little more attention, a little more spotlight to those kind of issues. And that's what we're looking for. I mean, that might be the perfect statement, but I think it does give a little more attention to it. So thank you.
Thank you, Manager.
Any other questions for the panel? Doesn't look like it, so thank you for being here. Appreciate that. And then, is Lauren still here? I saw her zip out. And Ozzie. Mr. Rose. Ozzy, I don't believe you were here last time, so if you wanted to make an opening statement and also respond to the testimony we've heard today, and Lauren, I assume you'll do follow-up to what we've heard today.
For the record, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ozzy Rose. I'm representing the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services. I have handed out testimony. Our executive director was to be here and give this, but she's ill this afternoon and couldn't come down from Portland. Essentially, the Alliance, our membership are the nonprofit long-term care facilities. Between us and Oregon Healthcare, I think we have all of the long-term healthcare facilities in one or the other association. And the essence of our testimony is that these issues are issues of improved training, and we have worked with the department over a two-year period under grants training people across the state in these kinds of issues, and we think that the focus ought to be on using the resources that the state has, and if the Parkinsonian issue is an issue that needs to be addressed in more detail, it should be addressed in the area of training. And I think the latter part of the testimony the last half hour or so, noting that the bill was to focus on other forms than nursing homes, and it doesn't suggest that more work needs to be put in. What are we trying to accomplish? And nobody wants to not provide. That's a double negative, I think. I think when I was in education, I knew better than that. But there's nobody that isn't interested in improving the quality of care for the people that we serve. And we're just suggesting that the focus on rights and more activities isn't the correct focus. Let's work with the department, get better training, more training through the community, and serve the people that need to be served.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Mr. Rose?
I thought that testimony you just handed out said you're in favor of the bill.
Sir, we're in favor of an alternative to the bill.
Okay, I'm sorry. I misread that reading.
I underlined that line when I got it because the first time I read it, I wasn't saying what I thought I was supposed to say.
Well, let me follow up on that. Okay. We just heard testimony from May Dash regarding Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's Network, and you're in favor of some training initiative relative to Parkinson's, but there are issues related to other types of diseases and situations, and I'm just wondering if you have any, what we're talking about could also apply to the Alzheimer's group. And
we just completed over the last 2 years under the grant from the DHS 24 sessions around the state training people to in these general areas, and if more needs to be done, whether it's Parkinson or Alzheimer's or whatever, that's the area we should be focusing on with the resources we have. And we're not sure, the early argument about where do fines go and so forth, we're not sure that that money can wind up or does wind up being used to solve the problem.
Because that would be my follow-up. What resources are we talking about to implement this?
DHS has federal and state resources. They provide grants. The grants we had were from the DHS. And sorry it was before I was here, but I don't know whether it was federal or state money. But there is money in that big building over there to do training.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Rose? Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for putting it quite succinctly, Mr. Rose. I would just reiterate, at reviewing the last portion of his printed testimony on the front side, page one, that the Alliance just completed a 2-year grant partnership with seniors and people with disabilities of the Department of Human Services on chronic diseases training for frontline caregivers in assisted living, residential care, and nursing homes, which is what you had also just stated. 24 trainings were provided across the state. 20 trainings were provided statewide in best practices. So, Madam Chair, I'm just thinking that this is kind of supporting what I think the desired outcome here is to improve the needs, meeting the needs of people in these various categories and in these facilities. And if education and training will produce that outcome, I'm kind of encouraged to see at least there's an opportunity to do that without perhaps the need for legislation, but I understand the focus is to drive that point.
This is definitely either a supplement to or an alternative to.
Right.
Absolutely. Thank you. Other questions? Maybe there might be more questions, so why don't we... Lauren, do you want to jump in?
Thank you, Chair Kotek, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association, and why I was a little bit late up here is because I was on the phone trying to get a better understanding of where the dollars do actually go. It's, I think we're operating under one assumption, and I just chit-chatted with Mary Gear right after her testimony. So I've gotten conflicting information from individuals in our association, but I do think in following up on what Ozzy, what you were just asking of Ozzy, I believe that according to Mary's testimony, yes, the dollars that are assessed from a civil penalty do go back into the general fund and are directed to SPD. It is my understanding that that funding is what was available to fund the training initiatives that DHS contracted with both the Alliance and with the Oregon Healthcare Association to provide specific disease training. And I, that's my understanding what I was getting off of the phone, and I wouldn't speak for the department, but that's something that could be followed up on and verified, I suppose. And so I guess that is, you know, some communication that I've had with members of the committee. We were operating under an assumption that the dollars were required to go into the general fund and that there was not a reallocation of them into the training. So if that's the case, then that's what it is, and certainly would be more beneficial. And in following up to what the department testified and then some questions from the committee, I did want to just I made a couple notes in my listening that I do think, not that there is a new requirement, so to speak, from these rights, because I do believe, like you said, Chair Kotek, they are already incorporated into both the federal and the state regulations, but what the implication, at least, of the medication management right would do is that if any deviation from the delivery of a medication on a time recommended or required by the physician would result in a violation of this resident right, whether it was for a Parkinson's drug or a Tylenol or some other medication. And so that's where our concern lies, in that this is broadly worded so as to apply across the spectrum so that you could result in tremendous number of violations. And similarly on the disease-specific training...
Yes, Representative.
Where do you draw that conclusion from?
Well, the way that Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlee, the way the bill is drafted in line 16 in the medical management assistance, the residents shall have the right to obtain assistance in administering medication that meets the specific requirements of the resident's disease. And under testimony that we heard previously from Parkinson's disease proponents, they indicated that their medication must be delivered at a precise time.
You have a statute in front of us, right?
No.
Do you see any here in the statute that says what you just said?
No, I...
From all kinds of testimony, that's fine, but the statute here.
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlee, this is just a concern of what we could see resulting from the imposition of the legislation as drafted, which I'm just trying to raise for the committee. And what another concern that we would see is that the training requirement is across all disease categories, and that that could result in beyond what the current certified nursing assistant training or nursing school training incorporates into the specific diseases that they include in their school requirements, and that that could be broader than what is currently educated. And I'm not, I don't know how many diseases there may or may not be in a facility that will be required to be trained on.
And that raises a question for me, Lauren. I think at the last testimony you had mentioned that the question was how many Parkinson's folks we might have in certain facilities, and I think you gave the impression we could actually get at some of the numbers based on disease. I'm just clarifying. It's okay if I got that wrong. I'm just wondering, was that true? Or?
Chair Kotick, it's our understanding that on the minimum data set, information that's submitted by a facility to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services via the Department of Human Services, they are required to indicate any diseases with each resident in each facility.
And follow up on that, is that just Medicaid and the Medicare patients or everyone?
Everyone in a facility.
So if we had that information, if we were trying to narrow the scope of the types of diseases that we would be focusing on, could we say, you know, the most prevalent ones or the top 10 prevalent? I understand your point about this could theoretically require a lot of training because there's a whole range of diseases that someone would have to get trained on around medication schedule and other things. I'm just wondering if there's a way based on the most prevalent ones as a way to narrow and either direct the training initiative or direct some regulation, you know, and get at some of those issues. I just don't know what those numbers are.
Chair Kotick, I don't know the answer to that question, and I think that would be something the department, if they were able to cull all the data from the various facilities across the state, they may be able to answer that question in terms of the prevalence of disease.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Bobby.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. Thank you. Either of you could answer this, I hope. And I'm wondering about the overlap between the disease-specific training and the medication training, because it seems that a concern was definitely raised about Parkinson's and now with Alzheimer's. If you're doing training faculty staff on the disease-specific, for example, Parkinson's, does that not include training regarding the medication required in that disease? Are they really two separate issues? If you're training somebody about Parkinson's, doesn't that include if the Parkinson's patients really do need their medication at specific times, is that encompassed in that training?
Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, I don't know what is encompassed in the training, so I can't speak to that.
Thank you for your testimony, and appreciate you coming today. And what I'd like to see is a little more offline conversation between people who testified today to see if there are some adjustments we can make.
Find out whether it can be made to apply to other facilities as well.
And I guess checking with LC about applying to other facilities. Before moving on, so if you could, and we are cruising to the end of the month here where we're trying to get things done, so Jim, I'll leave it up to your direction to talk with Lauren and Ozzy and May and just talk it over and let me know what you've come up with if there are some suggestions, and if there aren't, let me know that too, and then we can discuss with the committee how we want to proceed. So thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing. Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3093, and I have Ms. Peoples. Would you like to testify?
Yes, please.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Tricia Peoples, and I work in the Speaker's office, but I am not here related to any business there. I'm here on my own behalf. My father was diagnosed with Parkinson's about 2 years ago, and since that time, for about 1 year, I was a certified nursing assistant in various long-term care facilities here in the state. And so I think a patient's bill of rights is an excellent idea. One of the things that in my work I noticed that I would like to see a change for the better is the staffing ratios. And I felt that they were inadequate on all three shifts that I worked. And I think a bill of rights is an excellent idea. I hope that there is adequate caregivers available at all times to meet the needs that are outlined in the bill and maybe more. But I also just wanted to present myself as a resource to somebody who's worked in these facilities so that if you have any questions about the way things happen on the floor, I'm here to answer your questions.
Thank you very much for coming down to provide that testimony. Questions?
for Ms. Peebles. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Peebles. When you got your job, did you get disease-specific training on Parkinson's? And if so, did that include specific training on medication for Parkinson's patients?
It did not, but I was not certified to distribute medication, so that's a different job title than I held as a medication aide. But no, I didn't.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Peebles, and I appreciate you bringing a little bit of a sense of experience on the matter. I was just going to call your attention to Oregon Administrative Rules and that Ms. Gehr had brought to us from the Department of Human Services, and it talks about residents' rights and protections and talks about residents must the facility must implement a resident's bill of rights. So, in fact, there is one already in place that we're just talking about considering enhancing that. So, in your idea, it's a good idea to make the enhancements.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming down and offering yourself as a resource to follow up on that. So, appreciate that very much. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3093. And open a work session on House Bill 3017. Colleagues, if you'll remember, it's been a few weeks. We had a presentation from Dr. April Love on fluoride varnish. I don't know if you all tried your fluoride varnish. I have not yet.
I'm still in my file.
But we've heard a lot about oral health this session, and so we've asked them. An amendment to be drafted. And Sandy, do you want to walk us through this? If you were,
I do, Madam Chair. Just briefly, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, you'll recall, well, after our public hearing on back in March, we were looking at an amendment because there were some concerns about the bill in its original form. So we got together, came up with some language. Their DHS was very uncomfortable. And I believe the Board of Dentistry had some concerns about the bill in its original form with the requirements specifying certification of the counselors and the assistants, the process for verification. It was pretty administratively heavy for what fluoride varnish actually does. So we sat down, or I sat down with counsel, and we came up with something because, as you can see, and I believe April showed us, the fluoride varnish is just a Q-tip with fluoride on it that you apply to the teeth, and basically the recommendation was just to simplify the whole process. So we came up with the dash one language that just specifies that counselors and health assistants who have been trained in the application of fluoride varnish may apply it to the children who are enrolled in Women, Infants, and Children Program, WIC, the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, or the Federal Head Start Grant Program, eliminating all of the extra necessary administrative documentation required that the original bill put on DHS and the Board of Dentistry. Shouldn't have a fiscal impact. The Board of Dentistry is here just to provide any additional backup for discussions that I've had with him. I sent the email to Laura, the amendment to her, have not heard back from her, so I'm not sure. Laura Love, Dr. Love.
April.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's
okay. Somebody else.
Well, I was wondering if we could have the Office of Family Health and the Board of Dentistry just come up a moment, and in case you have any questions for you about the amendments. Representative Gelser, do you have a question? No?
Oh, I do have a question, actually. I didn't realize that you were coming in, but I do have a question.
Okay.
If I can ask it.
You may. And just to remind folks, I think one of the challenges with all the oral health issues we've been hearing is this is not as complicated as, say, the dental sealant issue with the dental hygienist. That does take a significant amount of training and oversight. Again, this is swabbing some, you know, fluoride on teeth, and Dr. Love's opinion was we just need to help facilitate this happening, that it's not a complicated thing to do. So, Catherine, would you like to say a few words about this?
Chair Kotek and committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, which houses both the oral health program and the Women's and Children's WIC Nutrition Program, and we appreciate very much working with you, Chair Kotek, and the committee in terms of finding some different language. What the concern was that we had heard from our counties was just to be able to have permissive language that would enable it to essentially be a county-level decision about if they wanted to support this activity in WIC, and I'm assuming in Head Start or something else, and use some of their funding for that, they'd be able to do that, but that it wouldn't be a requirement that would not have funding attached to it of all WIC programs in all counties. And part of that also is reflective that right now, with the concerns over the timber tax revenue, and our counties are doing very close scrutinies of their budgets, we've been having a lot of conversations with them about the WIC program specifically, because it hits such a critical group of our low-income families, and we have actually used a lot of their services to sort of do a number of unfunded extension, referral, and linking activities that right now our counties are actually having conversations about what are we actually required to do and federally funded for, and then what are the additional things we're doing that then we have the discretion to make that determination at the county level. So thank you very much. I think this would respect the needs of the counties. We do have counties that would be probably very actively engaged in this, and it provides a mechanism for that, but then allows other counties to make other determinations.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. And Patrick.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. My name is Patrick Bratz, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Dentistry, and we thank you again for letting us work on some language. We think the language is good. I've had some conversations with your administrator. We're just not sure where they're going to place the language, and that's one of the – it's not an issue for us. It's just we want to make sure that it's done appropriately so that no one will question that they have the ability to do this. And so we're more than happy to work with LC or whatever and placing it in an appropriate spot, so that no one will question that if it becomes law that these individuals, if they want to do so, will be able to use this process. And I did have Dr. Love put fluoride varnish on my fingernail, and it is very easy to do, so it's not a complicated thing. That's why you see it went from being a very long bill to a very short. It's not really that complicated.
And thank you. And thank you both for working with Sandy and Dr. Love on this. The permissive nature of the language is what we were trying to get at to facilitate more than just set up a whole new mechanism. So Representative Gilser, question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't ask this question previously because we hadn't yet had all the fluoride testimony. but I'm wondering, given that it's a constant, it appears to, I just pulled my stick out, that it appears to be a concentrated amount of fluoride, if there's permissive language that allows a child to have it applied at preschool or Head Start or at WIC, and then maybe the parent is taking the child to the dentist, would there be any keeping track of how often a child is having concentrated fluoride put into their mouth, or is there any danger if you had it done an extra time with you?
Chair Kotek and Representative Gessler, again, I'm not a dentist, but as has been explained to me, it's a pretty easy procedure, and because of the way it's done, and because you're doing it on small children, a lot of it is actually wasted. I mean, in reality, it gets on, but enough of it gets into the tooth to apply what is necessary. And so the discussion is, I'm sure you've heard with the fluoride debate, that, you know, children are not supposed to swallow fluoride toothpaste. It's not of that concentrated level, as I've been told, because of the fact that you do brush it on, but by the time you get a lot of it brushed on before it can even dry, it's already dissipated. So that my understanding is it's not quite as concentrated as if you would be ingesting fluoride from fluoride toothpaste. At least that's the way it's been explained to me. I've never had it because, as I said, fortunately or unfortunately, I came from a state that had fluoride, so I didn't need the fluoride varnish.
Representative Gelser, Chair Kotek, and I just was checking some of the papers that I was carrying with me on this. Catherine Bradley from the Office of Family Health. The concern that you raised, I think, is one that's been raised before, but the amount of fluoride that's actually diluted in the varnish is so small. The recommendation actually is that it gets applied if it's going to be effective 3 to 4 times a year. So multiple applications is not a problem.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a quick question, because we did sit through several hours of testimony, and I have received many emails and many phone calls and met with constituents. I have some constituents who wouldn't want fluoride varnish, even fluoride varnish, on their kids' teeth. So is there a consent obtained from the parent before this is done?
Representative Bonamici and Chair Kotek, in any case of any activity of what we're going to do, in terms of any sort of health-related activity, we always get parental permission. I would be hard-pressed to imagine that there would be a situation that an organization would actually approach this without getting permission.
Thank you for the clarification.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. And Sandy, Madam Administrator, Madam Chair, those who have collaborated on the amendments here, what type of training is anticipated for this swabbing with the Q-tip?
Chair Kotek, if I can answer, and Representative Flores, again, not being a dentist, being the layman person with the Board of Dentistry, Dr. Love was very able to show me in a few matters of seconds is how to do this, and so it's our belief that it's not complicated. Obviously, with anything that is a, quote, a drug, fluoride is, of course, a drug, you know, overuse or not doing things could be harmful, but I just don't see any more than just having a little presentation for the people that are working in the WIC programs and saying, here's how you apply. If you want, we can actually apply it on one of your teeth so you can see what it's like. Boom, it's done. It's not a complicated. That's why we really didn't want to get into all of this certifications and fees and all of this kind of stuff. We wanted to be very simple and get right to the root of the matter, not to pull dentistry, but so that the fluoride could be applied.
Chair Kotek and Representative Flores, one of the ways that we currently apply fluoride varnish is with our public health nurses and the Office of Family Health through our dental relationships developed a set of protocols that we released, and the protocols are used to train staff in terms of how to do that. So I think that we've got a mechanism for being able to facilitate that.
Great. A question for the Chair and Administrator. What's the status of the sealant bill, because we had one dealing with sealants, which I think is,
and we actually did more important pass that, and that might have actually gone to the floor. And I think the reason
and that's okay, because it was primarily around dental hygienists,
right,
to give them a little more latitude to do the dental sealant.
Right. So
I was
so
wondering that
was
where
it came up in the
right.
dental hygienist bill, and which of course needed a little more training and, like I said,
right.
supervision. So.
Representative,
would you entertain a motion?
I would. Thank you so much for being here and for your testimony and for your work on the amendment. Representative Gelser?
I would move the -1 amendment to House Bill 3017.
Thank you. A motion has been made to amend House Bill 3017 with the -1 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative Gelser?
I'm Madam Chair. I would move House Bill 3017 as amended to the full committee with AED pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. The motion has been made to move House Bill 3017 with the -1 amendments to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Erin, would you call the roll?
Representative
Collette. Aye.
Representative
Gelson.
Aye. Vice Chair
Von Meegen. Aye.
Vice Chair
Duran. Excuse. Aye. And with that, I will carry the bill to the full committee. Pass it on with a due pass. Thank you so much. And we have one bill left. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 3089. We're moving today.
I have to note that Mr. Kapoor has been very patient through this whole meeting, waiting for us bill.
So, Sandy, reminder of where we are on this. Back when,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3089 had a public hearing on March 29th. It is permitting a person who has completed a doctoral program in Oriental medicine that has received a doctoral degree from a federally recognized accredited school to use the designation of Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine as part of that person's practice. You had a -1 amendment at that hearing that had a tad bit of problems. What you have before you now is a -2 amendment, which actually has placed the very similar language, if not the exact language, under current statute that is identified as the use of titles for healthcare professions, and we have duplicated the existing form and style for health professional titles and incorporated it into the sub-9 of the acupuncture title portion of that statute. And so it should, I think it's a cleaner version, but it gets to the ultimate goal of what the acupuncturists are looking for. And Mr. Kapoori, as Representative Bonamici said, is here for the committee's pleasure.
So, Stephen, would you like to come up and give us your thoughts on the amendment? So after the last discussion, I chatted briefly with Stephen. We talked. I did think we needed some consistency with, remember, the physical therapist, House Bill 2386. So this is, this will look familiar to you in terms of the where we're sticking this in. And Mr. Gaffori, what do you think of the Dash 2s?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Gaffori, representing the Oregon Acupuncture Association. I just went to LC in the first place with a concept. They drafted it the way they wanted to and stuck it where they wanted to. I told the chair it really didn't make any difference to me. She wanted it elsewhere. It's elsewhere. That's just fine with us.
Well, there you have it. Questions, further questions, in case anything popped into your head from the last time we met on this issue? Doesn't look like anyone has any questions. I'll entertain a motion to...
Yes. I was going to make the motion.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3089.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bonamici has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3089. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative?
Madam Chair, I move that we send House Bill 3089 as amended with the Dash 2 amendments to the full Health Care Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bonamici has moved House Bill 3089 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Erin, would you call the roll?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Gelson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bonamici.
Aye.
Vice Chair Brown.
Excused.
Chair
Clinton. Aye. And with that, we will move it on to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. And any carries?
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Bonamici will carry that to the full. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3089. And just, can we just have a little check-in for folks on the schedule a little bit, Sandy, just briefly? So just to remind everyone, we have until the 30th of the month to move any House bills out. And Chair Greenlick and I have met. We've been talking about the schedule. We, at this point, are pretty much going to be just coming back to work session on things we've already heard. I don't think we have anything brand new.
I believe that there's something requested a public hearing on something, but I believe it is just a courtesy public hearing on a bill that will be on the schedule.
And then we will be having full this coming Friday?
Monday the 23rd. Friday the 27th. And Monday the 30th, because to have a subcommittee on Monday the 30th, which is our deadline, is kind of goofy. So we'll probably have a full those days. So hopefully, I've not sent an email out to the full committee alerting them. We're kind of leaning on the 30th as needed. In other words, that being the deadline, if we need to carry it over to any work till the 30th, we will do it. So that's kind of our fallback date. So an email will follow up, letting you know, and hopefully clear your calendars for that Monday time slot. The 23rd is a full, the 27th is a full, and more than likely any carryover will be on the 30th, since that is our absolute deadline.
And just keep in mind, we might have to go long on that day. Hopefully we won't.
And maybe even Friday, the 27th, because, you know, there is some bills. And I believe all the members know, the process is, all the agendas up until the 30th will have to be issued by the 20th. Any revisions after the 20th will require speaker's approval. So then those agendas...
Any additions,
right. Removals, generally, we can do, but if there are any additions to revise an agenda. So just don't be surprised when you see all of a sudden you have all these agendas on your desk in the next few days.
The goal is to get, and if there's something missing, and hopefully we've gotten everything,
right,
or there's something you're wondering where the status is, please talk to myself or Sandy
so make
sure we don't miss it.
The 23rd and the 25th.
No.
And the 27th.
So just the 23rd and
this
the 27th.
This Friday and the following
the
Monday. So we have four more
Each
polls.
Of the Mondays.
So two more Fridays and two more Mondays.
Right. 27.
Because right?
Representative Greenlick's subcommittee has lots of
Don't
bills.
We have three more Fridays?
No. 20th, 27th. And then
20th and the 27th. And this one.
Well, this is the 20th.
The
20th. Right. So we have the 27th Friday.
Is it anyway?
23:30 Monday.
And we're losing some members for this Friday.
And then after that, we'll get back to the Senate bills. But we're holding off on the Senate bills because we don't really need to move them as quickly. So, Representative Gelser, you had a question?
I
I now forgot what my question was.
Okay. Well, if no one has any other questions, we are adjourned.